is a little bit of a change of pace for me because as a campaigner, I do a lot of cultural competency trainings and working with Amnesty members. And although there is some crossover in the work I've done with our Stop Violence Against Women campaign worldwide, looking at Right to Health, it's nice to work on something like this and present something, this report here today, because I feel very close to it, not only as a campaigner, but also as a researcher. I helped about 2 years ago research portions of this report, including one of our sites where we did the research, Oklahoma. You don't really have to follow my PowerPoint. I do have it printed out, but I did put together some formal remarks just so I can explain to you, since many of you might not know, the key findings of our report. And I'm really interested in the questions you might have afterwards. I've tried to keep it light on jurisdiction because it is a report primarily looking at jurisdiction. I've drawn out some of the access to health components of it. And hopefully in the discussion towards the end, I'm really curious and anxious to hear, because there's a diversity of folks' background in the room, about opportunities, recommendations you might have for, as a campaigner. Selfishly, I'd like to hear a little bit more about what we could do as an amnesty campaign with some of the collaborations we have and coalitions we're building. Because now from our Stop Violence campaign, we're going to be shifting in 08 to a ESCR, Economic, Social, Cultural Rights campaign, which will have a very strong component of health, access to health and housing. And I'm hoping this report, being a work on own country report, you know, we do so many reports at Amnesty that focus on other parts of the world, as Dabney mentioned, but doing something on own country will not only help the indigenous communities, but also the non-native communities that are also affected with, and some of the stats we see in the report also come from sexual assault cases in non-native communities. So with that, I'll backtrack and say that I'm giving overview today of findings from a 2007 report that just launched in April called Maze of Injustice, the Failure to Protect Indigenous Women from Sexual Violence in the U.S. I thought, you know, although I have some stats up with the PowerPoint, it's really important to have some of the photos of survivors and advocates who shared their stories with us, introduced us to others in the report, and continue to work with us on a campaign. Most notably, Sharon Asatoya from the Dakotas, who's working with us on the right to health component of our campaign. So before we went into the research for this report, we had heard that Native women are 2.5 times more likely to be raped than any other woman or sexually assaulted in the U.S. More than 1 in 3 Native American and Alaska Native women will be raped at some point during their lives. And from Department of Justice stats, we learned that 86% of the perpetrators were non-Native men. So this is a report looking at non-Native perpetrators committing sexual assault against Native women. Sadly, our research revealed that these stats, as shocking as they are, probably were being underestimated. And some of the indigenous women that we interviewed during the course of our report said that they didn't know anyone in their community who had not experienced sexual violence. It's also important to note that this report isn't just about numbers and stats, but it's really looking at the stories the women shared with us. We really wanted to show the stories and incidents of women being raped and those who hadn't seen justice for the crimes committed against them. So as I mentioned, this research was developed and conducted in close collaboration with many Native and Alaska Native women and organizations. Tribal Law and Policy Institute is one organization we worked really closely with and continue to work on. The report presents a national overview of the problem, but it primarily presents specific findings in key areas, Oklahoma, Alaska, and the Standing Rock Reservation, which straddles North and South Dakota. We selected these areas because they had specific jurisdictional and policing arrangements where we really saw challenges that women were facing in responding to crimes of sexual violence. The report confirmed what many Native American and Alaska Native advocates had known for a long time: sexual violence against women from Indian nations is at epidemic proportions, and that because of very complex jurisdictional barriers and a chronic lack of resources for policing and health services, perpetrators are never brought to justice. One woman who we spoke with in Oklahoma said, "Women don't report it because it just doesn't make a difference." Now, we found, although Native American and Alaska Native women are victims of such shocking levels of sexual violence, the federal government has created substantial barriers to ensuring that those responsible for these crimes are brought to justice. Now, the report goes more into the federal government creating this complex jurisdictional maze that's so confusing it pretty much just often allows perpetrators to evade any sort of justice. It makes it difficult to figure out which authorities should respond when any woman in a Native community does pick up the phone and call to report that she's been raped. Three factors that often determine who responds and prosecutes a reported rape include whether the rape took place on tribal land, whether the victim is a member of a federally recognized tribe, and whether the attacker is a member of a federally recognized tribe. And the answers to these questions are often not immediately clear, and it can be quite confusing. All too often, the confusion and time that it takes to determine who, whether tribal police, the FBI, or local police department has authority to respond, really means that there's inadequate investigations or a failure to respond at all. In remote parts of Alaska, we learned that 1/3 of Alaska Native villagers that are not accessible by road have no law enforcement presence whatsoever. And in the Standing Rock Reservation, we learned that there were 8 patrol officers at the time of our report, there are now 6, responsible for covering 2.3 million acres of land. That means there's only 1 officer on duty at any one time, and survivors of crime often have to wait hours, if not days, before receiving any response from police. What I wanted to focus on today really was talking a little bit about where our campaign is headed right now with the Indian Health Service, otherwise known as the IHS, and the lack of access to sexual assault forensic exams, which has created quite a bit of attention in the media since our reports launched from advocates, Native and non-Native, and from our members and the general public. So the lack of sufficient resources, including emergency services that women urgently need following a rape, including critical medical exams that could yield evidence to help and prosecute rapists. The U.S. government, we found in our report, has chronically underfunded the Indian Health Service. When women go to a health facility after they've been raped, they may discover that there are no qualified staff, such as sexual assault nurse examiners, also called SANE, S-A-N-E, who are trained to provide medical forensic exams. Sometimes the nearest medical facility with staff who are trained to conduct any sort of forensic exam or rape kit may be so far away that a woman may face a round trip of hundreds of miles to reach it. In Alaska, we learned a woman may have to travel by plane to get a medical exam, which deters her from getting the immediate help that she might need. And we also heard that in Alaska, many women have to pay the cost of their flights, which can be extremely expensive. Now, I've mentioned a couple of, I wanted to keep it light on jurisdiction. I'm looking over my notes trying to think of what might be most interest to an audience like yourself. I guess wanted to say that, while the voices and the stories that were shared throughout the report, speak of grave violations of human rights, these women's voices also send a very strong message of courage and hope, and they really are expecting some change to happen. Everywhere we went, people had ideas, solutions, and the report contains, in true amnesty fashion, about 53 recommendations. Now, looking at the key recommendations, we're learning that with 550 nations, there's really no one-size-fits-all. Plans of action have to be developed to stop violence, and there has to be a consultation between federal, state, tribal governments, and indigenous women in particular, to develop effective plans to stop violence against women. Now, this also includes many of the health professionals we spoke with, the direct service providers, who are often frontline, whether it's urban or rural area. We also need comprehensive data on rape and other sexual violence to be developed in consultation with tribes and really to show us where offenses took place and status of both victims and perpetrators and prosecutions, why cases are being declined, again, getting into the jurisdiction. So the immediate action that Amnesty took after the report launch was really to look at the Violence Against Women Act. And again, just since we've brought it back home and looking at domestic legislation, Amnesty was really calling on Congress to fully fund VAWA, also known as the Violence Against Women Act. And as a result of the advocacy by many of the women that we had interviewed, we found that VAWA now contained a tribal title, Title IX, that looked to seeks to improve the safety and justice for Native women. The tribal title is the first ever effort within VAWA to fight violence against Native and non-Native women, and it makes some recommendations. Included in Title IX, there should be a national baseline study on sexual violence against Native women by the National Institute of Justice, really examining the problem and looking at the effectiveness of tribal, state, and federal response. Now, this study could be used to help identify solutions and plans of action. Title IX would also include a study on the incidence of injury from sexual violence and a tribal registry to track sex offenders and orders of protection. Over and over, we were hearing that protection orders were pretty much a joke if your perpetrator was non-Native. And stalking was quite common as well. And it also sets aside 10% for important programs, which we were hearing over and over from survivors, advocates, law enforcement officials, saying they really needed to have that money set aside for law enforcement, courts, and shelters to provide the key services that would really ensure justice for Native women. Now, one of the actions that's on the table there that we're promoting in Amnesty during our 16 days of action, which is November 25, the UN's Day to Eliminate Violence Against Women, to December 10, which is Human Rights Day, really targets the IHS, which quickly after the release of our report, they had their Dr. Grimm, who was their head of IHS, resign, and now they have an acting deputy director. We hope to have some visits with the permanent appointee in the new year, but for now we're really hoping to have a letter writing action again in true Amnesty fashion that's looking at the U.S. Congress increasing funding for the IHS and all contract facilities. Such monies could be and should be used to increase the number again of sexual assault nurse examiners so that survivors may receive timely forensic medical exams at no charge following a sexual assault. Furthermore, the IHS should ensure that appropriate protocols are in place for the treatment of survivors of sexual violence. Over and over throughout my interviews in Oklahoma, we were hearing that there were just no protocols that existed, and people were really looking to find some effective plans of action so that they would get their rape kit free of charge. In Oklahoma, we learned that unless you know right away that you're willing to prosecute, you don't get a free rape kit. And that really goes against a lot of national guidelines. So something really quickly that we were able to do is just talk to the state senator there, who is presenting some new legislation in January that we're writing along with advocates, because that's something very easy that we can, you know, get taken care of. And we're not really sure why that still remains the case, not only for Native but also non-Native women in the state of Oklahoma. We're also developing similar strategies, campaigning strategies, in each of the three sites that we really feel a great responsibility to continue to work with the advocates in, again, being Alaska, the Dakotas, and Oklahoma. But we also have this advisory group that we've convened, and we're now with Amnesty and a couple of other coalitions as well, to really look at some of the other states and to make similar recommendations and see what we can do. I'd just like to maybe give you three of the ones we're moving most quickly on this fall. In Alaska, we've realized that we really want to ensure that Alaska Native women survivors of sexual assault receive the timely sexual assault exams free of cost, and they don't have to pay for transport to health facilities. In Oklahoma, again, we're looking to cover the full cost of the sexual forensic exam, regardless of whether the survivor decides to report the crime to law enforcement officials. And in Standing Rock, it's really looking at the just how few shelters there are on that reservation. We're really looking for the federal government to provide funds immediately for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe to support its shelter for survivors, and the government should ensure that there is additional funding to support the increased capacity of shelters throughout North and South Dakota that provide these services to women. Now, we're really looking at this campaign and to keep this report visible for the next year, but again, we're really hoping that it also fits well into our ESCR campaign looking at access to health services and housing. But we're really hoping to continue to raise the visibility and awareness of what is going on. We've had extensive media coverage and just lots of hearings, not only in the field, but also closer to home now here where I work in Washington. The Senate Committee on Indian Affairs has been very interested to work with us, the National Congress on American Indians, and they really are putting together quite a few hearings to hear about not only law enforcement, but hopefully in the next few weeks we'll be hearing from more health professionals and direct service providers to speak about some of the challenges that they're seeing. And we've heard that Senator Dorgan and Murkowski, who are the chairs of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, are also from states which we highlighted in our report, are most interested and really shocked at what's going on and are quickly putting together legislation with some of their other colleagues. The letters of concern keep coming in. Just last week, we heard of a new rape case in Mobridge, and just again, some of the same stereotypes that have come up in other reports and campaigning that I've done, looking at violence against women and the layers of discrimination, continue to come up in Native communities. Where I know that in Oklahoma, quite a few of the survivors that I spoke with and some of the survivors who are quoted in our report spoke to me about the stereotypes that exist. Oh, it's just another drunk Indian, or rape kits, just being denied rape kits, evidence being destroyed, and that was the end of the road. And you had women as young as 9 and as old as 65 being run out of their communities. Similar, challenges that we see in other countries I was seeing, and nothing really should, I think, shock me anymore doing research with Amnesty, but I was really shocked to see what was happening so close to home, where people were leaving their, really being forced out of their communities. And again, the stigma of rape and just that inadequate response, where women are really stigmatized by not only family, friends, teachers, and their community. Just wanted to end a little bit more, because I have a feeling my time might be coming to an end, and you might have questions more on, and I would really be interested to hear about the forensic exams and health services, and what your take might be, and what, you know, you might have heard from other Indigenous forums at this conference, or recommendations you might have for us. That aspect of this report, the health services, is most important right now for me to work on. Survivors of sexual violence are just not being guaranteed access to an adequate, timely rape kits, which are critical not only in prosecution, but also are fall under right to health. Now, this result of the U.S. severe underfunding of the IHS, the principal provider of health services for American Indian and Alaska Native peoples, I recognize that the IHS facilities are suffering from understaffing, high turnover, and a lack of personnel trained to provide emergency services to survivors of sexual violence, but they really haven't prioritized implementation of such programs. And there are some good models around the country in states like Wisconsin and Minnesota that they can look at, where registered nurses with advanced education and clinical preparation in forensic exams are available throughout their facilities. Although there are no figures on how many IHS hospitals have SANE programs, officials indicated to Amnesty that fewer than 10 had implemented such programs. We've also found that many of the IHS facilities, again, lack the clear protocols for treating victims of sexual violence and health services for survivors, such as testing for STDs, pregnancy testing, emergency contraception, and culturally appropriate support services are also inadequate. As I mentioned, in some cases, the law enforcement have mishandled evidence from forensic exams from healthcare providers, including through improper storage and loss of or destruction of evidence before a forensic analysis has been carried out. I guess I'd like to end with, again, what I campaign on most of the time, speaking with folks about how sexual violence is not only a criminal or a social issue, but it's a human rights abuse. And the U.S. has ratified many of the key international human rights treaties that guarantee Indigenous women's protection against such abuses, including right not to be tortured or ill-treated, right to liberty and security of person, and the right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. I think I'd just like to end with that all women do have the right to be free and safe from violence. And I do encourage any questions, because I've glossed over a really long report drawing out the health part. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up for questions. We have time for questions for Zainab, and also a little bit more time for questions for the other presenters as well. And there are also some materials that Zainab has brought specific to the Maze of Injustice report that I want to point out over on the water table. Yeah, Corey.
Sites in the state of Oklahoma where I did the research along with Native advocates was in the rural areas. We were finding in Tulsa and Oklahoma City there was more money put aside for the SANE nurses to be trained, and more of the shelters and the rape hotlines. I mean, specifically looking at sexual assault in this report, even domestic violence services. But it was really the rural areas that were saying it's like being in another world. No justice for survivors of sexual assault. And most of the survivors who are in the report, including a very brave young woman, Jamie, who is sitting on the fence in this photo. She does a lot of speaking for us now. She's from a town in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And she was one of the cases where when she was in just graduating college a few years ago, she was raped by an acquaintance. And, she came from a pretty affluent family in this town of Tahlequah, had all these resources to an attorney, didn't know right away if she wanted to prosecute, was able to pay for her rape kit, and a few months later when she decided she was going to prosecute, when she'd had some time to get some counseling and some other services, she was told that her evidence was destroyed in a routine cleanup of the storage unit, and just nothing, nowhere else for her to go. Yes. Yeah, well, again, looking at Oklahoma as an example, you just had folks who had no idea who had jurisdiction. So you would have, when they're, if they're the first responders, whether they were tribal, state, or feds, just didn't know who had sometimes the jurisdiction. In Oklahoma, it's, we picked it because it had kind of a unique case of being like a patchwork. There are no reservations in Oklahoma. So you can be in Indian country on one side of the street, and the other side of the street's non-Indian country. So as I quickly mentioned in the beginning, usually then you have the first responder trying to figure out, well, is the perpetrator Indian or non-Indian? Is the victim Indian or non-Indian? And where did it happen? Again, the lack of the clear protocols, there should be some cross-deputization agreements. That's one of our recommendations, because we've really seen it work in a couple of sites, including on in Alaska in a couple of villages, where it doesn't matter if you're a federal, state, or tribal, you just have to have the protocol so you know to call the direct service provider to be there as a support for the survivor and to collect the evidence and to, you know, go interview the perpetrator. Just the lack of clear protocols is, I think, the biggest barrier to any prosecutions. We're really not sure why so many cases are being declined when we do find that someone does happen to follow a protocol. And some places you really do have some great law enforcement officials who've just, you know, created their own based on some of the other issues that kind of take priority in their communities, whether it's child incest or meth or whatever they're, you know, dealing with in that community. So one of our actions, hopefully that's going to be picked up in January, is really targeting the Executive Office of the U.S. Attorney General's and to find out from them why are these cases, why are they being declined? Because when we sent out our surveys from Amnesty, we just got zero response. Folks in DOJ were just told not to respond to Amnesty. So now that the report's out and there'll be some pressure, hopefully they'll respond. I haven't heard of any cases like that. No, I haven't. Do you know of any? Or?
No.
I haven't seen any case of that, no. Some of it's happening, but again, it's happening slowly, and because I'm, you know, and others are trying to present in conferences like this, going to powwows, going to just as many human rights organizations, direct service providers that we can, and to tell them about the problem. Because, you know, it's a shame. This work, Stop Violence Against Indigenous Women work, has been going on for years, and I think that's why there was a lot of wariness in Amnesty being a non-Native organization and kind of this big gorilla coming and doing the report and getting so much attention, because there are groups like Tribal Law and Policy Institute, Mending the Sacred Hoop, Sacred Circle, they're all on our website, who've been doing this work for a long time and have been on the Hill with the National Congress on American Indians, have been talking to the Senate on Indian Affairs, and have been working with groups like the ACLU and so many others that do good work. So we're really excited to see collaborations like that coming. It's probably not for, you know, Amnesty to take the lead on it, but I would definitely encourage everyone to visit the website, look at the recommendations, and to pass on the report, which we've quickly run out of 5,000 copies in the last 2 months because there's so many things going on this fall. But I have a sign-up sheet, and I'd love to get copies out to people, and folks can get in touch with me, because we have all these interesting things happening, some low on the radar and some high visibility, that we're trying to promote and connect people with others. So we welcome any sort of collaborations like that. It's being led by the Native Advocates. I mentioned Sharon Asatoya at the beginning of this presentation, who's a leading health advocate and has worked with a lot of violence against women organizations, including Eventsler's V-Day, and she's worked with Amnesty for many years as well. And so I'm really trying to take the lead from her and other advocates who know their communities the best, connecting folks with others. So yeah, we should definitely talk.
Any other yes, one more question, yes. Anybody else wants to take on that question? I don't want to hog the mic. There are a number of charter documents. The one you mentioned is TB specific. There's another one called the Ottawa Charter. Charter documents tend to be non-binding declarations, which means they're not legally binding on, for example, a healthcare provider. It's more a statement of aspiration that the patients believe that these are our rights and flip side responsibilities or duties. I think a lot of times when people engage, therefore, with health and human rights issues or rights-based approaches, we tend to go to the safer sources of law, those more kind of conventionally accepted as binding sources of law, which include the International Human Rights Treaty, international human rights treaties, a couple of which have been mentioned, I think, in these presentations. The main one that deals with the right to health is called the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. It's a document from 1966. It's a UN document, and it includes an article on the right to health. That's the shorthand for it. And unfortunately, that's not a document that the U.S. has ratified, but many, many other countries have ratified that document, and it is a source of law for countries, because whenever countries have to agree to ratify these international human rights treaties, they also have to incorporate the treaties into domestic law. So internationally, I think that's kind of the gold standard, is that there are these international human rights treaties. States can choose to ratify them and incorporate them into their own domestic methods. And where that really puts the onus is really on the relationship between individuals, which is the way in which human rights are often talked about, the right to this, the right to that, and the state government. And so there's a lot of conversation and debate about kind of community rights, collective rights, how those might be different. And also the rights and responsibilities of individuals, the rights and responsibilities of non-state actors. You know, we have very many powerful entities which are not states, transnational corporations, terrorist organizations. There's a whole gamut of non-state actors, pharmaceutical industry. And then state actors, who are the ones that ratify the documents and say, yes, we agree that we have this responsibility. And those responsibilities take a variety of forms. And they can include, as Julie Gerberding said yesterday, protection. That's the one, for some reason, that the U.S. seems, I think, because it brings up, war on terror, kind of protect you from the horrible external scary stuff. But there are responsibilities of states on a number of levels, to respect your rights, not to violate your rights directly, to protect you from other outside actors who might violate your rights, and then to fulfill, which is what we often talk about when we think about the kind of positive rights like health, where, you know, we have to have an infrastructure, we have to have clinics, we have to have healthcare workers, and the state has some responsibility to help make sure that those infrastructure components are in place. I don't know if that answers your question directly. A little bit, maybe. Okay. Any other questions? Well, on behalf of the International Human Rights Committee, I want to thank you all for coming to this panel, and I'd like to again thank all of our presenters for their presentations.